Welcome to The Point. I'm Indy Todd. Today it's our on-air book club. We discuss Noe Alvarez's memoir, Spirit Run, a 6,000-mile marathon through North America's stolen land. U.S. born to an indigenous Mexican family, Alvarez joins a group of indigenous young people on a 6,000-mile run from Washington State to Mexico. And Noe Alvarez joins us. Good morning.
Good morning.
And also with us is John Hanlon, who's worked on the Cape and Islands for more than 20 years as an educator, counselor, and advocate for marginalized youth and the environment with the Mashpee Wampanoag Tribe, Provincetown Public Schools, Cape Cod National Seashore, and Cape Cod Community College. John, welcome.
Good morning. Thank you.
John, you were the impetus behind our choice of Spirit Run for this month's book club read. Why did you suggest this book?
Well, I heard Noe on another podcast on NPR, Living on Earth, and I just was so really engaged in his story. You know, I've worked with Latino immigrant kids when I did high school and at the college, and now when I work with the Wampanoag youth, and I just saw the connections and the everything there really perfect. So I wanted, you know, the kids to read it.
Yeah. Noe, tell us more about the Peace and Dignity Journey Run. What does it aim to accomplish?
Thank you. It's such an honor that you guys selected my work. Peace and Dignity Journey is a marathon, virtual marathon that happens every 4 years from Alaska to Panama, and it's always growing, it's always expanding, it's always inviting people to join. And, you know, just that, peace and dignity, it's a movement of runners that connect between indigenous communities across North America and South America, hoping to reconnect with the communities and sit with the youth, sit with the elders, and reacquaint ourselves with the stories of the land, holding ourselves accountable to the landscape, to our people, and essentially carrying your community forward. That's the running that we do. It's not a competitive run. It's a run for your community. It's about carrying those bundles of stories that represent who you are, where you came from, and what you could become. And so yeah, it's a lot of things depending on who you ask. Each runner has their own reasons for joining the run.
It's interesting because you just mentioned it happens every 4 years. So what were some of the events or emotions that got you to the point where you said, you know what, I'm going to quit school and I'm going to do this run rather than, you know, waiting until you finish school? What was happening that you decided in that moment this was something you had to do?
I think my whole upbringing sort of was preparing me for this moment. All my life with Mexican immigrant parents, who labored in the fields, and we struggled to make ends meet. And so all my life, all the narrative was getting into school. School was going to be the thing that saved my family, that I needed to save my family financially and everything. The burden was on me. When I finally got accepted into a really good school, it sort of came down on me. It didn't really heavily. I had no idea what to do next. There's a lot of shame around my struggles in college. I wasn't prepared, and it happened to sort of coincide with my meltdown. Happened to coincide with the movement that I heard about from a friend of a friend, and it just hits you when you sit there and you watch the organizers or people who have participated on the run talk about this run. It just hits you very powerfully because there's people there modeling sort of behaviors that I wasn't used to. People who talk openly about the things that they're working on spiritually, the things that they are looking to do in their community, sort of the fire within them. It was a very powerful thing for me to hear at age 19. And I said, I have to do this. This is my college. This is the education that I needed to do. And so I decided to buy a one-way ticket to meet the runners in Canada and didn't look back despite some of the hiccups.
Yeah, John, talk a little bit about that. I mean, I think as we're reading this book, it really gives us some insight into the struggles that, you know, many of these, as Noe is saying, there's different reasons. People have different reasons for wanting to take part in this. I think my heart was breaking, Noe, for your mom, especially your dad, too, but your mom, especially maybe because I'm a mom, too. But it just broke my heart reading some of the struggles that these families go through. And John, so this is a book really everyone, you know, not just Indigenous people should be reading, everyone, to give us some insight into what's happening, right?
Yeah, and that's exactly it. I wanted to write from the perspective of being left out. I wanted to capture that pain of being dispossessed by grief, being dispossessed by machines, being dispossessed by your labor. And I wanted to really capture the reality of what it was like to work in the warehouses and what my mom continues to do and a lot of people. I didn't want enough people to turn away from this. And so in a way, in a lot of ways, I wanted to expel the pain. And I wanted to capture and honor the stories of the people who made my life, understanding my life in this way possible. So I'm nothing without my people. And so this run is about all the runners that had an impact on me, you know, the people who had an impact on me, my parents, on these runners, and then challenging what it means to be Latino, what it means to be Indigenous, and what it means to be working class. So it's a lot of things, it's a lot of layers, and if anything, it's just a conversation starter about how messy we are as people and the work that it takes to bring us together. And on Peace and Dignity Journeys, running was our medicine, running was the medium by which we came together and had those tough conversations. We confronted very tough conversations, and so it's all that. It's about trying to deal with that pain.
Yeah. John, your thoughts?
I think the connection between the Indigenous and the the immigrant population is really profound, and it happens here in Noe's story. You know, we have so many families and kids here on the Cape at the colleges and the high schools that they don't have that. They feel they don't have that voice. They're living between two worlds, kind of. You know, people don't know what their parents went through to get here, and sometimes the kids too lose touch with that. So to be able to do something like this that reconnects that story with them, and then of course to reconnect with the earth and the place that we have, and you know, initially you don't think there's maybe that connection between the Indigenous and the immigrant, because you know it's such different. They're treated so differently in our country, but they're both marginalized populations, and I find some of the same issues with both. You know, going away to college like Noe did, and not being able to fit in, or having a voice here in the community. So, all that connects.
Yeah. Noe, you wanted to do a little reading from the book, right? Did you want to do that now?
Sure. Yeah, no problem. I will be reading the Palm Springs of Washington. When the rhythms of working class life cut inside me like broken beer glass, I run. I run in order to dislodge my problems from where they have taken up residence, and I come upon the Natchez River with my parents' stories in hand. I run hard until my thighs burn toward the tributary of the Yakima River, until I can finally clear my throat of anger, slapping my face and chest to remind myself of this heavy flesh, the burden of being human. I run to find relief and to help activate a power within me, pushing myself hard over hot pavement as if to extinguish flames from my feet, to find courage along river that flows beside mobile home parks, graffiti landmarks, beer hop factories, and gravel pits. The river and I run next to the Boise Cascade Lumber Mill with its stacks of felled logs. We run by a billboard that reads, "Welcome to Yakima, the Palm Springs of Washington," a name intent on covering up the messier realities of the town. Here, east of the Cascade Mountains in Washington State, where the sun shines roughly 300 days a year, is my desert, my hometown of Yakima. The summer evening air swells to the high 90s. Hay mounds, truck stops, and cattle dot the landscape. A sun-baked barn is painted with the words, "God Bless America." In this region, rich volcanic soils turned over by the hands of many generations of laborers, beginning with the Yakima First Nations people and people from Europe, Africa, Japan, the Philippines, and now Mexico, have made this land one of the world's leading producers of apples, hops, cherries, and wine grapes. It is a paradise on the surface, but its history is harsh. It is a region that cycles through its most vulnerable people, immigrants who plant and plow. Someday my parents too will pass into the volcanic soil that enriches the region and that I now caress with my palm of my hand along the river where I pause to catch my breath. When I resume running, I kick my feet into the ground and huff between my steps, moving into the peripheries of the camps of homeless men and women who live in the tents along the river, among the tall brush littered with beer cans and syringes. This is Raymond Carver country, an area whose working class narratives have been articulated to the world in the short stories of the local author. Here, along the rivers, old hills, and ghettos, I do most of my thinking about what it means to be a son of immigrants, what it means to be working class, and what it means to run and explore the land on my own terms, to find forgiveness on a land that feels sometimes like it has broken me, to carve my way out of Carver country and create a new path for myself.
No, wait, tell us what a typical day was like and describe the route of the run. I mean, it changed, right? I mean, you didn't really know exactly what the route would be when you start out. So tell us how that's decided and what a typical day looks like.
Yeah, every day was different. Every day we were committed to running through a different community. We would wake up very early before sunrise and run until sunset often. We'd wake up to have ceremony with the community that we were with. We would dedicate that day to a specific story represented by a feathered staff that had prayers on it that represented specific things. An elder would ask us to pray for their community, decimated landscapes. Someone asked us to pray for a child who's battling with drug addiction. So every day was a different reason for running and a different reason for picking up that staff. We would run in a pickup. We have a pickup drop-off vehicle. We had no technology, so oftentimes the coordinators put out their maps on their hoods, and we committed to running. And there was a saying on the run, you know, if you got lost, take a left. Essentially, you'd be running in circles, and they'd come and pick you up eventually. Mm-hmm. We often got lost, so we were often correcting our mileage. And we would relay. So it would be a minimum commitment of 10 miles a day. And, you know, when runners got injured, we made up, you know, we had to jump in and make up those miles. And then we'd run to the next community, sit down, have ceremony, have potluck, and sit down with the stories of that community in ceremony so that we can carry those the following day. So it was a lot of that, cycling through communities, cycling through those stories, and running, you know, long hours in communities. So,
and it could be, and you know, just thinking of not sometimes, you know, getting lost, not knowing where you're going or where you're supposed to be going, and trying to figure that out. That can be, you know, take a toll on you. But there's at one point you are running through an area that isn't really clearly, you know, marked or trails, and you come across, was it a cougar or a bobcat? I can't remember. That was a pretty scary moment.
Yeah. And that was what the run was about. In a way, you had to find the reasons for running. It was voluntary, and you had to find reasons for continuing that run. And you know, I was in Oregon, and we were often running through mountains and trails and always was looking for something that's not supposed to be there, right? Someone would leave you a bundle of sticks or an arrow water, and you were supposed to take that as a sign to take a left or to take a right, and that wasn't always available. And we were running just with our staffs, nothing else. And so when I encountered that mountain lion, you know, that was just one of the many that happens to you on the run. Runners were running in bear country in Alaska, and so it was just one of those things that you had to sort of contend with and find your reasons for staying strong and learning to see the beauty in those scary moments. You know, at the time, I didn't know you were supposed to run away from a mountain lion. Thank God. I you know, I'm here to talk about it today. But
yeah.
Yeah, and I could have quit then and there, but you know, there's I just couldn't stop because of the powerful stories that I was engaging with, and my heart was healing, and I was all the beautiful people that helped us out on the run. So yeah.
We have an email from Debbie from the Friends of Eastham Library, and she says, wanted you to know that Spirit Run is being read by a lot of Outer Cape residents. The Eastham Library has more than 20 copies available for circulation, and we have been promoting it on the Library and Friends of the Library Facebook page and Instagram pages. We are aware that Wellfleet, Truro, and Provincetown Libraries also have purchased copies of the book. All are available to your listeners through the CLAMS Network. Thanks for all you do. So great to know that if folks are haven't read it and would like to, it's available. 866-999-4626 is our number. If you'd like to join our conversation, that's 866-999-4626. Our email address is thepoint@capeandislands.org. We'll talk more after a quick break. You're listening to The Point. It is our on-air book club. We are talking about the memoir Spirit Run, a 6,000-mile marathon through North America's stolen land with the author, Noah Alvarez. And also with us is John Hanlon. He's an educator, counselor, and advocate for marginalized youth. 866-999-4626 is our number. That's 866-999-4626. Our email address is thepoint@capeandislands.org. Amy sends an email. She says, I was so disappointed to hear about the bullying and harsh interactions between the runners and organizers. It seems so out of place with the idea of a spirit run. How do you reconcile this with the goals of the run?
That's a great question. I had to sit with a lot of things, and I wanted to write something that captured the reality of the work that it takes to build a community. I didn't want to shy away from the mess. Right. I wanted to find power. I wanted to find transformation in there, and I wanted to be honest. You know, I am in conversation with a lot of the runners, and it was a lot about just trying to honor the process properly. So for me, that's, I guess, the way I reconcile it is it's sort of the process of how I wrote this and the process of how I ran, about this desire to basically expel this pain, you know, and that the process wasn't pretty, you know, it was more like we're limping, literally limping after this reality, this space that we were trying to carve out for ourselves, and you know, just trying to capture in the language, you know, the language of suffering and the language of what it meant to put in that work. And so yeah, I really wanted to include that. I wanted to have something for other youth, other people who could, you know, the story could resonate with and see. That was a surprise to me too when I joined the run, right? You know, I had this idea of what the run was going to be like, and I got there, and the challenges, right? And you can't escape those challenges. Wherever you go, there you are, right?
Right. So, John, how do you talk about that aspect of the book with the students that you work with?
Well, I think with any, you know, any marginalized population, there's bullying, and I mean, just look at bullying that goes on right now in our political system with immigrants. But I think being able to hold on to that sense of who you are, you know, your pride in your place in the world and your family and your tradition, that's what really we try to focus on, you know, with both Native folks and with immigrant students, that to get beyond that, because that's always going to be there.
Yeah. So, Noe, how did you and others successfully navigate the differences, you know, and were you able to do so in a way that when you left it, there were feelings of mutual respect?
Well, there's a reason why the run happens every 4 years. We're saying that the work continues. It is never over. And it's a matter of creating time and space to having those tough conversations, right? And so the way we addressed it on the run, that we had circle. We would have circle as long as we needed to, which meant it was canceled. We would sit down after our runs, a long day, and we would write this out until we got it. People had different ideas about what it meant to be a runner, right? And they had different ideas on how to do ceremony. People had different upbringings and different stories and different reasons for why they wanted to honor the things that they wanted to. And we had to sort of try to find, you know, peace in that process as long as it was, right? And so it's never over. I just wanted to sort of create a something honest about all the different ways that we do get dispossessed and all the things that we do internalize and all the things that do get in the way of our progress. But it's an ongoing process, you know, and I think we come at it our way. You know, like someone said, these are tragic tales of all the ways that we've been displaced. And so it's just about merely going on. And that's really the ultimate gesture of this run, using running as an alternative form of language. When words failed me when I was younger, when I spoke Spanish and got in trouble for speaking Spanish, words weren't always there for me. So So we always had to find a different way of expressing ourselves, and running was that sort of physical gesture, sort of that religion of finding our place on the land with people who are also struggling to find their place on the land. And that's just representative of our communities.
Yeah. And you talk about how much this is a lot of running that's happening, and this is tough on your bodies. And we have an email, but you pushed yourself to the point that your knees were the size of balloons and you were in tremendous pain. And Dale writes, got up early this morning to finish this book. How are your knees? Did you suffer permanent damage? And how and why did you keep abusing them? Enjoyed reading your thoughts as your days went on. Dale, thanks for the note. So how are your knees?
They're much better. For a long time, I couldn't run after that. I told myself I needed to run as long as I needed to, and I think that was part of the lesson of the run too. One of the hard lessons is knowing when to quit, knowing when not to take on more weight. I had a lot of weight about my family. I had all these stories that I wanted to burn through. I wanted to transform. I put a lot of weight on my shoulders. And I really wanted to run as many territories as I can and connect with as many people as I can. So it was a matter of just trying to find my balance. My knees are great. I still run. I had to go through a healing stage afterwards, separate from running. I had to, just slow it down. But that was sort of the reality of the run, of just merely going on and getting to the next story is what motivated me when I was 19 years old.
Yeah. So how do you look back on the choices you made to continue the run despite your pain?
I tried doing this run a couple years. I encountered a couple of runners in D.C. who were running from California to New York. And I was in D.C. at the time, finals week, and I sort of gave everything up again for an opportunity to finish a run. I really, really wanted to finish a run. And so I joined them for 3 days from D.C. to New York, and it felt so good. It felt very healing that, I just feel like, so I was reconnecting with it in other ways too, but that mileage was necessary. That ceremony for me was very important to me. It needed to happen the way it did. And that was just the way I was trying to find a language for contending with my past. I don't regret it. I tried doing it again 4 years later. Didn't last 3 days, my body said, hey, what are you doing? And so, I joined the run in the Northwest for 3 days, and I was planning on doing that on the book tour this year, prior delays to the delays. But that was one way that I was trying to show and honor this story. And this book was inviting people to join in on a 5K with me. And the run was going to happen this year, but that also got delayed, and it was going to go to Ecuador. But it's growing more and more. There's a PDJ run in Jamaica. There's a PDJ run in South America. So it's getting bigger every time. As soon as things are safe to renew, I think it's going to kick off pretty hard.
Yeah, let's talk to Debbie, who's giving us a call from the Eastham Public Library. Hi, Debbie.
Good morning, Mindy. How are you?
Good. Go ahead, Debbie.
So, we are delighted to have this book being discussed right now. Our group has been talking about the story of the first encounter for the 400 commemoration, and the encounter between the Nossi people and the passengers and crew on the Mayflower. And our idea was to talk about the themes that the Native people had in common with the colonists at the time, and explore, for instance, youth and how hard it is for youth on Cape Cod to make a living and survive here. And, it's not the same parallel. And so when the book discussion opportunity came up, we wanted something that would help us explore those themes. And we also wanted something that would be healing. And so we reached out to our group, and John suggested this book, and he told us the story about not only Noe's book and his journey, but also how he was bringing it to the youth of the Wampanoag students at the college and at Mashpee High. And so we reached out to our library cohorts from Provincetown to Eastham and also the Mashpee Library. We've all purchased books. And this book has been such a wonderful journey, and it is accessible to everybody. The chapters are small. Everyone says a different, you know, has a different story to it. And I found it so incredibly healing. And I'm so thankful to both John and Noe for writing this, because everybody should be reading this book right now, the way this country needs to come together to solve such huge problems. And the fact that we have such an opportunity to come together again. I'm just calling to thank everybody and just to say this is something we all need to read and think about and talk amongst ourselves.
Yeah, Debbie, thanks. Debbie's bringing up a really good point. Noah, you had a number of different stories, different characters, and I think Debbie's right. We can identify with the different people and you know, like their reason for running or, you know, what their story is. And John, I imagine for you, that is part of the reason why this book is so appealing to you, because it you know, especially for marginalized youth, it's like you might have a tendency to think, this is just me. I'm the only one who feels this way. So to see other people's stories and be able to identify with that is very powerful. Right, John?
Yeah, definitely. And kids, like talking about the Eastham 400 series, I had one of the Wampanoag kids came in and spoke. And I think maybe through this book, he found his voice. You know, he spoke up about, we're talking about the first encounter, yet, you know, I'm 2 miles down the road, I have to pay $20 to get onto a beach that I should have tribal rights to, you know. And so I think kids being able to read this book and reflect on it, they would recognize themselves and some of those characters and find their voice and honor their own story.
Yeah. Noe, we tend to categorize people into specific groups, Latino, Asian, Black, Indigenous, and we fail to fully appreciate that those groups are not monolithic. So how did your perception of the term Indigenous people change from the start to the finish of the run?
It continues to change, you know, and I think it should. And I think, you know, it also depends on who you ask, right? So for me, I guess I just wanted to sort of complicate the narrative, I guess, you know, and I think that's important, and I think there's beauty in the complexity. I wanted to make the story accessible. I just wanted to start a conversation. This is a conversation starter. I wanted to create a space to amplify the voices of the people who had an impact on my life, and I wanted to show how complicated things were, and it wasn't meant that it takes hard work to build community. But it's worthwhile work. It's beautiful work, and we were doing it around running. And so, yeah, I wanted to complicate it, our understanding of these, you know, these, you know, when we tend to label people. I think it's different, you know. We all have very specific stories, and we were literally pushing ourselves beyond our comfort zone. We were literally running from community to community, getting into those spaces that either, you know, potentially scared us, or going into cities or running in certain times of the day. No, we had different, you know, reactions, but every time we crossed into those communities, you know, we built family, we built community. And so that's the thing that I think we need today and more than ever, right? It's putting in that work, a willingness to put our judgments aside and complicate our own narratives and try to see how much alike we really are.
Yeah, community, central theme to your story. And of course, community is wonderful when you feel you're part of one, but emotionally draining when you feel excluded, right? Or that you don't fit in. You highlight both those feelings in the book. John, what are your thoughts?
That's definitely true. Community is so important. And I think the Cape is unique. We do have a wonderful community, but there's still, you know, a lot of people feel excluded, and I think to be able to build that community better, we need to be, you know, try to be more inclusive of other people and what they've gone through and what their story is.
Yeah. Were you writing during this run, or how much writing did you do on the run, and you know, when did you decide that this was going to be a book?
That was a long process. I did have a journal on the run. I took my notes. I had an idea that I wanted to do something with it. I carry that story with me still. It continues to inform my life today. I had sort of like the longest kept secret. A lot of people didn't know about this for a while. And then I just decided to do some additional self-care and decided to join a community writing class many years later, and found myself writing around the same sort of themes, and people, you know, encouraged me to do more with it, because that's an important thing to do. And for the longest part, it took me a long time just figuring out how to tell it, trying to contend with, you know, was I the right person, right, to tell my parents' story, the runner's story, you know, how to properly honor their stories, and was I potentially putting my family in danger, exposing them to the life that they were doing, you know, a lot of things that were, you know, really tough to contend with. But then realized I needed to tell a story. I had an obligation to put this kind of story out there, put in that work. I put it down. Running was very healing to me, but writing it was another form of healing, and now speaking it is another form. So it's been good, it's been necessary, and it's been beautiful.
Yeah, you know, we talked about some of the dangers, physical dangers of the running and running into the mountain lion, but there were actually areas where the runners would be where you could be harmed intentionally. That just blew my mind, where one of the runners was saying how she had to jump out of the way of a car that, you know, this was not an accident. That was just amazing to me that people would intentionally want to hurt you.
Right. And that was very painful for us, for our runners, just to show just the level of tragedy that continues to inflict, you know, these communities, the tensions, right, the racial. People did not want us always in their space. They didn't want us asserting ourselves so forcefully in that way, running with staffs that represented, you know, the power of communities, right, that presented stories. They didn't want us asserting our humanities. They wanted to continue to erase us. And so this was sort of a continuation of the colonization that has decimated these communities. That was one reason why the communities were referred to as their indigenous original name, not the name that you know, that pressed them, right? And so I didn't know where I was at half the time until we hit cities like Vancouver, you know, the bigger cities, L.A. And so we were in this other world, and we were very, you know, scared at times that this was a reality that we had to contend with, and we couldn't quit. It was a lot of people were depending on us to carry the stories forward, and we had a lot of we had to depend on each other to be there for one another.
866-999-4626 is our number. That's 866-999-4626. Our email address is thepoint@capeandislands.org. We'll talk more after break. You're listening to The Point. It is our on-air book club. We are talking about the memoir Spirit Run, a 6,000-mile marathon through North America's stolen land. We're talking with the author, Noah Alvarez, and John Hamlin, an educator, counselor, and advocate for marginalized youth. 866-999-4626 is our number. If you'd like to join our conversation, have a comment or a question, that's 866-999-4626. Our email address is thepoint@capeandislands.org. John, just before the break, we were talking about the racism that the runners faced in different communities. And, you know, here in Cape Cod, predominantly white, and I think there are some people here who sort of turn a blind eye to that, but it is very prevalent. And I'm wondering your thoughts as we've seen the Black Lives Matter movement come forward. Do you have more optimism now that we can address systemic racism, or do you feel like we've been down this road before and you're not as optimistic? What are your thoughts?
I'm very optimistic. I'm very optimistic along, you know, communities, people, you know, are failing to see one another as human. And the run, you know, Peace and Dignity Journeys is sort of putting our feet, you know, getting out there and using our run as an organ, of speech, you know, sort of this anatomy of resistance. And so I think what we need to be doing is denaturalizing, you know, sort of rearranging our relationship with the land and ourselves and our communities and with the people around us. And I think people are doing that. I think people are asking us to have tough conversations, and we need to have those more than ever. And so I'm very hopeful that people are coming to the table. They're very tricky, messy times these days, and this has been going on for a generation, right? And so now it's just in the open, and that's just the difference, I think, is that things are now in the open. So I personally feel that it's going to get harder, but I think there's a willingness to put it out there. I think there's an urgency to put in that work and get everyone to the table. Because people are shouting, we're in an urgent time. So I personally am very hopeful that things are going to change and get better.
Noe, what are your thoughts?
John, you mean?
Just on the times we're in and the, you know, the Black Lives Matter movement. And yep. Do you feel optimistic?
Yeah, I definitely do, especially with the younger generation. They don't. Just accept things the way they are, like maybe earlier generations did. You know, they question and they see other possibilities, and also there's that connection to the land that's come back with the younger generation. So I definitely am optimistic, and even with some older folks, like at the college, we have so many people that volunteer. You know, we have a wait list at the adult ed center at the college of 800 people to learn English, and we have folks that are volunteering to help and teach English, and I'm very optimistic.
So getting back to the book, what were the biggest differences that you observed between different tribal ceremonies within the United States and then those that you participated in once entering Mexico? And what does ceremony mean for you?
Yeah, those are very great, complicated questions, and it changed every time. what the point of the run was to join a community and celebrate it on their terms, to learn from them and how they honored their land and how they sang their songs and what they wanted to do and how they wanted to run. You know, and at the Honotem Nation, you know, we ran always together. We had longer miles. We were running long hours. That's the way it needed to be done. And so, of course, people had different ideas about whether we were doing it well, whether we were committing ourselves the way we needed to. And then, you know, it changed even more when we went down to Mexico. So one, the ceremonies were in Spanish, a lot of communities, and even then, not Spanish. A lot of communities didn't speak Spanish down there. So there was a little translational barrier there as well. But there were things that did get translated, you know, the universality of sitting around in a circle, letting people contribute to the movement however they wanted to. You know, if your heart was in the right place, you were welcome. You had to sort of find your own rhythm, your own way of running, your own way of prayer, your own way of committing to the movement. And that's where we needed you. That's where we need you. You need to find what you're good at, flex that muscle, because we need you in there. And so, and every day was learning. It wasn't that I got into a community, did a ceremony a certain way, and then went into the next one, and that's how it was again. We had to go in there with an understanding that things were going to change, and we had to honor that as best as possible. And that's sort of kind of the message that, you know, I'm trying to relay, is that's sort of the level of curiosity that I want people to maintain. We got to stay curious. We got to stay motivated and learn. You know, and there's a lot of wisdom out there, and we can't shut ourselves down that way. And so being curious opens up your doors and in a lot of ways.
Yeah. Talk about how the run changed for you when you entered Mexico, the homeland of your family.
It was tough for me and powerful for me. You know, it was finally running into the homeland, finally running into the area that my parents escaped. They ran northbound, right? And I ran south. And so I was running in the complete opposite direction, trying to find transformation and healing in movement. There's this legacy of this, you know, migration in my family, this, just being displaced, being moved, just wandering. So when I wanted to, what that was, wanted to make it my own. I wanted to make it beautiful. And so going down to Mexico was complicated. I had a lot of ideas of what it might be like to be down there. I had my own series of obstacles down there as well. Our movement sometimes got pulled into very different directions, politically, from depending on the lands we were in. We ran through autonomous zones of Zapatista region, and so we ran with a lot of people. And it didn't change. And I think the only thing that changed was the language, most part.
So, did you feel more connected with the land or the people in Mexico than you did in the other places that you ran?
Yeah, that's a very good question. You know, I felt connected, you know, in all the land. And then the only thing that changed was just the border that was placed upon those people, because, like, the Tohono-O'odham region, the border splits them in two. But they are family. You know, it's the same land. The lands changed, connected differently, right, because of where my family was from out there. I ran harder in the regions of the Northwest, and I ran harder in the regions of Michoacán, where my parents were, you know, from. So there's a definitely personal aspect to that. But I think there's something very universal about the landscape and the people that you meet, very humble and beautiful people.
Yeah. Talk to Tom Ryan, who's calling in. He's with the EASTTM 400 Programming Committee. Hi, Tom.
Well, good morning. And I'm also with the Migrant and Refugee Committee for the Cape Cod Council of Churches, and I work with immigrants on the Cape, you know, a huge amount of time. And I want to thank Noe for this book, but also for the skills that your education in the past decade have provided you, because we need your skills everywhere. Like on the Cape, for example, we've got Haitian communities who don't talk to Jamaican communities, who don't talk to the Black Brazilians, and none of them seem to talk Black Lives Matter. And I'm Irish background, and Noah, your work in Ireland on the reconciliation there, you know the different clans within the Irish themselves. So what I call for, Mindy, was to say there's a piece of the book on page 27 where Noe talks about this acts of camaraderie that can connect people better than words. And I think the topic you just spoke about ceremonies, getting into each other's ceremonies, connects people better than words can. And I think that's what we need on Cape Cod and everywhere, to sort of not just try to be united by talking at each other or at each other, with each other, for each other, not just talking, but entering into each other's quote-unquote ceremonies, into each other's ways of finding who they are, and acts of camaraderie will get us much further than arguments of words.
Such a good point. Yeah, that's a really good point. Yeah, action. When I say actions speak louder than words, right?
there it is. And entering into their actions, not the actions I want.
Right.
When I'm visiting with a Brazilian household, I don't bring them my Irish background. I want to enter into their Brazilian activities. So,
And Tom, you're part of the rewriting the history of the first encounter at Nauset to include the Native American perspective. We've got a lot of rewriting of history that we need to do, don't we?
Everywhere, absolutely. And every generation needs to do that, because what we think, Mindy, we're convinced, you know, I suspect we're convinced we have an understanding of what's going on and what's causing some of the division today. In the next two generations from now, they'll be trying to rewrite what we did.
Tom, thanks for calling in. Yeah, thanks for calling, Tom, and bring up some really good points. Noe, how do you think the run impacted the direction of your life once you finished?
I think the most powerful way that it impacted my life, it finally gave me a framework for having those tough conversations. Sometimes what we do is that we try to bury some things within us. We try to distance ourselves for fear that we don't have sort of the mechanisms, the rituals for having those conversations, and then to pull ourselves away from that again. So for me, my way of processing now tough conversations, tough stories are through running a stroll in the park, or you know if it's safe to do so, you go out there, finding a moment, a time to sort of those realities and contend with that. Whereas in the past, it was hard to let it sit on my shoulders any more than it already was, for fear that it would collapse on me. And kind of to what the guest speaker was saying just now was, you know, what do we do when we don't, when words are not enough, right? And I think we are there more than ever, where words are not enough. They are something and they're very powerful, and that's what I'm doing with this book. But I think trying to capture the actions that would bring us healing, you know? And so sometimes when the world is still, I go out and I run. I do that physical thing. I commit myself to a schedule. I commit myself to a ritual, whatever that looks like for you. You know, if it's not running, whatever, you got to make time to sit with those realities, and then you gotta commit to something beyond words to bring you healing.
So how did your perspective of yourself, your family, your class, your race change over the course of the run? It changed who you are, right?
Yeah. I mean, I first learned how to love myself, and it brought me profound love for my family. That allowed me to be easier on myself. It allowed me to sit more proudly with my narrative, and to be more open about all the things that didn't work, but all the things that did, and trying to pass that message on to other youth, to take pride in our messy upbringing, but to put in that work and that willingness to connect. So yeah, it gave me a lot of self-love, a lot of pride. In my community, in my past, and so I have an obligation now to try to share that with as many people as possible.
What did your parents think after the run? I know they were disappointed in the beginning that you were leaving school, but what did your parents think when this was all said and done?
I didn't tell much, tell people. I didn't tell my mom very much of what I was going to actually be doing. I didn't want to inflict any more pain. And when I did, and I finally told her when I came back, she kind of slapped me around and told me, but they understood. They understood that, and that my intentions were good. I think they felt the love that I was trying to convey in the gesture of my run, that I wanted to run in their name. I wanted to run for all the pain that was, in Yakima. I wanted to just contend with that. I needed to heal, and they understood. So
John, we have about a minute left. Final thoughts from you?
Well, actually, I just wanted to ask Noe a question, if I could. I know at the end of the book, you come back and you're living in Boston, and you talk about when you're on the subway and you're reminded that you're surrounded by people who know where they're going, and you'll always be, you call it working class. Do you still feel that way, or was that something that you wrote back in 2004?
Yeah, I do, I think I do, but I know I'm changed, and I'm different. I'm continuing to grow and change. But I always had to remember where I came from, and I always had to connect with my community, and it's important for us to stay plugged into our communities, because we can't move forward without them. So, who I am continues to change, and with my environment and with the people and the work that I put in out there. That's a good thing.
Yeah. As I say, we continue to grow as time goes on. Noe Alvarez is the author of Spirit Run, a 6,000-mile marathon through North America's stolen land. John Hanlon is an educator, counselor, and advocate for marginalized youth and the environment. Thank you both. And Noe, thank you so much for writing the book. We really appreciate that.
Thank you.
Thank you.
We'll have links for more information of the book at our website, capeandislands.org. I'm Indy Todd. Thank you for listening.
The Point is produced by Amy Vince. The executive producer is Mindy Todd. Production assistance from Jenny Junker and Dan Tridle. Theme music by Benjamin Verdery and William Coulter.